Welcome to the Full of Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 6:15 British Summer Time. Well, this being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. But before we kick that off, let's have a look at the various moves that happened in or a quick recap of what happened today. I suppose the most important thing that happened really was that you had this U.S. statistic coming out adding fewer jobs than forecast, which led the markets to believe that we're not going to see a rate hike this month, that this pause that's been speculated about will definitely happen this month, at least that's the perception. And of course, that had some pretty spectacular effects. First was Treasuries rallied quite significantly. They hit a high of 109.19, so that's a good rally there from Treasuries, leaving behind that area of resistance at the June highs. And we'd have to give it more or less the benefit of the doubt unless that's countermanded pretty quickly. Then the currency also got hit in here. The euro is at 128.93, so it's up almost 1 cent. And the pound is remarkably strong in here because you had that interest rate hike in the UK yesterday, and now you've had this negative news coming out of the US. So versus the dollar, the pound is up 2 cents. It's at 119.87. So that's looking very strong, and it looks like it may go and even test the high at around 195, 196. So that's something to keep an eye on for if anyone's buying holiday money going to the US, from the UK, that is. Next thing, because there was this news came out, you had an initial rally right across the board in the equity markets, and you had Europe close up pretty much well up on the day. There was eight markets, sorry, in Europe were up over 1%. The FTSE, having had that big decline yesterday, was up 51 points, so certainly adding a little bit more support there following that downward move yesterday, putting a little bit more confidence back into the market, although it would need to hold it on Monday. And you had a move of nearly 1.5% on the DAX today, making a new high for within this overall medium-term correction. So things are looking up a bit there in Europe. Now you did have a commensurate rise in the US. However, because you had these bad tech results coming out, and because the options investigation that's going on may probe Apple. Apple declined, took some of the technology shares with it, and the Nasdaq 100 is down 15 right now at 1,506. So it's a bit of an up and down day here for equities, and it'll be interesting to see where they close today, because this perception of interest rates should really outweigh any negative impact that it would have on a share like Apple. Sorry, should outweigh any negative impact on the market that Apple would have. Now, looking at the commodity sector, oil is currently down 120 at 74.26, and natural gas is fairly steady around 7.22. So, not really much to report there, but in the industrial metals, you'll see those two news items I posted there for copper, and copper is up $15 right now at 660, or sorry, 364. Nickel is up 1,300 points at 25,700. Zinc is up 100 at 3,420, and sorry, 3,420, and lead is up 18 points at 1,135. So positive day here for the industrial metals, and likewise for the precious metals. Particularly silver. Silver's up 39 cents at 12.49. Gold had been up quite a bit more earlier on in the day, but it's dropped back. It's only up 2.79 right now. It's at 6.47, but then holding steady around the 6.50 mark right now. Now, moving on to the bigger picture themes. I'll start off with equities. And first with the US markets. We would say that we think that the US markets are in a secular bear market. And we define that as a generational period of PE ratio contraction and rising dividend yields. Now, what that means is that over time, people's expectations or investors' expectations for return are likely to go up. So they're going to want, instead of willing to pay very high valuations because it's a growth stock environment. People are going to look more for value. They're going to look for more yield, and greater yields, bigger dividends, will pull back those PEs. And when we look at PE ratio charts, then you can see that it's very much in a declining pattern. Excuse me. So, what does that mean for the rest of the world? And you might well say, well, if you look at the Dow Jones, it hasn't declined very much at all from its high, and the S&P is not that far off its high either. So you might think that it's not in a secular bear market at all. Excuse me, I'm just going to take a drink of water. Excuse me. But the main thing here is that a bear market, unlike a bull market, we recognize a bull market very simply because you see rising prices. But because we define a bear market as a generational long period of PE ratio contraction and rising dividend yields, it means that while those valuations can contract, the factor that will determine whether prices fall a lot, like we saw in Japan in the 90s, or stay steady, like we've seen in the Dow and the S&P, is a factor of liquidity. And because the Fed has been pumping liquidity into the system at an unbelievable rate and well in excess of GDP growth, that has helped support the markets, not just the equity markets, but all markets and all markets around the world. Excuse me, I've got a very scratchy throat. I'm going to cough, I'm afraid. Sorry about that. So, liquidity really is the dominating factor when we look at the very long term and we look at the effects that the bull and bear markets have had over the very long term. And when the Nasdaq bubble burst, the Fed had been doing research on how to avoid the kind of impact that the bursting of the Japanese bubble had on the Japanese market, and they pumped liquidity rather excessively. Of course, that wasn't the only time they'd been pumping liquidity. Central banks have been using just about any opportunity to add liquidity into the market, and they've been doing so right through from long-term capital management, through the Asian financial crisis, the Russian debt default, the Argentinian debt default, Y2K, 9/11, and right through until now. And when you look at, obviously we can't look at the M3 for the US anymore, but you look at those M3 and M4 figures for the European Union and the UK, you'll see that they're growing their money supply by 8 and 9%. And that has definitely helped to support the markets. Now, we've had a rally over the last 3 years, which was really quite impressive and was getting a bit long in the tooth, and we had predicted that you'd have a medium-term correction, which we're currently in, and that's by no means over. But it is really only a correction, because when you look at the valuations of stock markets right around the world, while the US is still relatively overpriced, particularly the Nasdaq, and I'll just pull that figure up right now. For the Nasdaq Composite, the valuations are a PE of 45.5 and a dividend yield of 0.83, which is really quite expensive when you compare it to something like Thailand, where the PE is in single figures and the dividend yield is, I think, about 4%. But the reason that we thought that this is a medium-term correction as opposed to a complete reversal, which would see us go back and test those lows of 2001, is because of those valuations. Because even though the US is relatively expensive, when you look around the world, you can see that in Europe and in Asia, and maybe not so much in South America because they have appreciated really quite spectacularly, you can see that valuations are really not that expensive. And following this correction, some of them have become really quite appealing. So, this is being a medium-term correction. We're looking for this to end sometime in the autumn. And right now, many of the stock markets, particularly in Europe but also in Asia, and increasingly with the major caps there in the US, the S&P and the Dow, are starting to look a lot more positive. You have a progression of rising lows, and some of them have higher highs. Well, that's the definition of an uptrend, and we'd have to give those the benefit of the doubt right now. Over the course of this month, I think it's highly likely that we're going to see some sort of downdraft or some reaction within the trend, and it's going to be remarkably important to find to see whether they're going to find support above the July lows. If they find support above the July lows, we can say with reasonable confidence that those June and July lows were important lows, and the medium-term correction could be closer to being over than we originally thought. On the other hand, if they do break through those July lows, and indeed those June lows, well, that could lead to some really quite frightening or traumatic further declines. By which point, of course, we would get even better bargains if that were to occur. But right now, we can give the upside the benefit of the doubt because that is the reality that the market is providing us today. Now, I've been talking about Japan versus the US, and you can see if you look at the long-term chart of Japan in the chart library, you can see that it really was a grinding water torture type challenge to be in that market over the last 16, 17 years because it just ground down. Every single year was just a major challenge to be in that market, and that was because of liquidity. They just did not pump enough liquidity into the system and squeezed too hard to burst the bubble. We would argue that the Japanese market has broken up from its base, did that last August, sorry, July or August, and is more or less in the process of that first step above the base. It had a very good run. It's consolidating that move now well above the base, and once it's completed that, and that we may be able to say that that has happened maybe in 6 or 7 months' time once we found a bottom in this global medium-term correction. But once it's done that, we can expect it to move into a more gradual and steady uptrend. Because while it took 17 years to unwind that spectacular once-in-a-lifetime bull market, it's, well, I think it's probably, I think a good word for it is that it's been rehabilitated. It's done its time, and it does look like it's broken up from the base, and there are spectacular gains ahead of it in the future. Now, when you look at the Nasdaq and you compare that to the Nikkei, there's a glaring similarity in the pace of the upside, and they both came off very, very quickly. Now, when people talk about a new tech bubble or a new tech bull market, well, when you look at the amount of time that it took the Nikkei to rehabilitate, and then you look at the Nasdaq, the fact of the matter is that even with all the liquidity was able to help the Dow Jones and the S&P, so the bigger companies in the US to survive. But really, those tech stocks have not been supported in any way at all. I think the amount of liquidity that was pumped into the system helped a large number of them not to go out of business. But the chances of us seeing the Nasdaq hit its or challenge its all-time high before the Nikkei, I think, are zero. So that's one way to look at the Japanese market, and I think the Japanese market is probably our favorite of the developed country markets, followed, I think, by Europe and then probably by the US. When we look at the other Asian economies, Korea would be well up there as well, because when you look at the Korean charts over the very long term, after that amazing run up sort of in 97, before the financial crisis, it's been going up and down since then, but never really challenged the all-time highs. It's starting to do that now. Looks like it's breaking out from this very long-term base, and this could go really quite a long way forward. Now, when we look at the emerging markets, India is our very favorite emerging market for the very long term, and there are a number of reasons for that, but primarily because it's got the demographics, it's a democracy, it's got rule of law, and it's got, you know, property rights, all of the types of things that are the foundations for capitalism and for the ability to grow wealth in the Western world. And we have all of those in India. Not to mention the fact that it is an incredibly vibrant and diversified economy, which, with the amount number of young people that it's producing every year, it is going to grow beyond our wildest dreams over the next 10 to 15 years. So that's our very favorite market. Now, that you might say, well, China has got the same number of people. However, China is not a democracy. China has no rule of law, and China has no property rights, which means that if you were to put your money in China for 15 years, you're not at all guaranteed that it's going to be there when you come back. So while the Chinese stock market is doing remarkably well right now, we will, as investors, will only do well in the Chinese market when it's in the interests of the apparatchiks for us to do so. And right now that's definitely the case, because the stock market was the worst performing market in the world for 2 years running. Last year, it became a political embarrassment, and the government got together and said they were going to support the stock market, and they've done a very good job at it. And that would probably, I think, continue at least until the Olympic Games, when China really wants to showcase itself as a successful control economy. However, over the long term, it's not going to be in the interests of the apparatchik or the government to really have a very successful stock market, because the way these governments keep control is to control the money, and it's not in their interest to have a free flow of capital and people through the stock market. So, excuse me, I'm going to just take another a drink of water. Excuse me. Sorry, I'm going to have to cough again. Terribly sorry about that. I think these long-term audios tend to take a bit of a grind on the throat. But that's our mostly our view for stock markets. Next would be, because you have this enormous amount of liquidity flowing around the world, that means that not only does liquidity, the amount of liquidity that was pumped into the market, go to the US economy, but because we live in a liberal economy, we can take any money that is made available to us and we can invest it just about anywhere we want. And that's what people have done. So liquidity has found its way into just about every single facet of our lives. And because we've had liquidity being pumped into the economies at a much greater rate than GDP growth over the last 5 to 10 years and longer, it means that that is starting to have a gross effect on inflation. So, when you look at gold in a number of different currencies, you'll see that it's appreciating in just about every single currency. And the only explanation for that is that gold has got is getting more value in the eyes of investors. It's seen as a store of wealth. Because not just the US, but every single central bank in the world is running a fiat currency system, and they are printing money like there's no tomorrow, because no country wants a strong currency relative to any other because of the competitive forces of globalization. That means that if my trading partners are printing liquidity and flooding the market with liquidity to hold down the value of their currencies and make their exports cheaper, well, I have to do the same thing, because otherwise my currency is going to get much stronger, and that's going to hurt my domestic producers. So every country is doing the exact same thing. So when we look at the M3 rates for the European Union, and they're going up at 8%, and we know that the dollar index has been going sideways more or less for the last 3 or 4 months, we can infer from that that the US is definitely adding at least 8% at a rate of 8%, because if it weren't, the dollar would get very, very strong. And the last thing that the US wants right now is to have a slowing economy and a strong dollar, regardless of what Treasury Secretary Paulson says about wanting a strong dollar. There's no way they want a strong dollar, particularly when you've got the slowing economy. Now, because you have this incredible amount of liquidity flooding around the system, that also means that you've got the specter of inflation rising. And inflation has, I think, right now it has definitely started to enter people's minds, because even though statistics have been manipulated over time to just about take inflation out of inflation measures, we know, as people who pay bills, pay insurance, buy food, buy petrol, pay for utilities, pay for services, all of these things have gone up, and they've gone up far in excess of 2 and 3%, which is what they tell us that our inflation is. So even though, because you had this massive bust in the Nasdaq and central banks were afraid of inflation, or sorry, afraid of deflation, and dropped rates to an incredibly low level and flooded the market even more with liquidity, they became quite afraid of deflation, when the result of their actions has been to spark a new inflationary cycle, which means that precious metals are only going to go up in value. And we can see that from the long-term charts of gold and silver. Because, I suppose not least because we have plenty of data going back historically for gold. And when you look at the Dow-gold ratio, you can see that over time, if you look over the last 100 years, there have been big spikes in equity prices, but it has always returned to a ratio of about 5, which means that it needs 5 units of gold to buy 1 unit of the Dow. Right now, gold is at 644, and the Dow Jones is around 11,000. So that's a ratio of about 15, and we expect that to go back to about 5, and possibly a little bit lower, which means that with the amount of liquidity in the system, it's unlikely that the Dow is going to halve in value. But it's not at all unlikely that gold could double, triple, or quadruple in value over the course of this bull market. The other major theme that we look at is supply and elasticity meets rising demand. Because when you have massive countries with massive populations like China and India and Indonesia, Pakistan and the Middle East, when they're faced with one problem that we definitely don't have in the West, and that is that they've got massively growing populations. I think in some of the Middle Eastern countries, 60% of their people are under the age of 20. And when you look at I think India has to find something like 140 million jobs a year. Don't quote me on that. I shouldn't quote those figures because I don't have them in front of me. But India has to create jobs at an incredible rate every year for the next 10 to 15 years, which means that they have infrastructure to build, and they have to build it in a hurry. And because the last bull market in commodities or industrial resources was in the 70s, and subsequent to that, because inflation was falling, and because interest rates were falling, that's very good for stock markets, not very good for commodities over the very long term. And mines started to shut down. And because mining was no longer a very sexy industry, you didn't have people going into it. You didn't Any companies that survived by being smart about their resources. So when prices were high, they got the easy stuff, and when price sorry, they got the hard stuff, and when prices went down, they got the easy stuff. And they didn't invest in a lot of exploration, but got at the easy seams that they had first. Now that you have demand far outstripping supply, it hasn't really dawned yet on, I think, many of the mining in the mining sector that this is a secular bull market, and this could last for a lot longer than people anticipate. So particularly, you can see this with the scramble around for Inco and Falcon Bridge and Phelps Dodge, Teck-Kominco. All these medium-sized mining companies are scrambling around trying to get a hold of one or the other to become too big to swallow up, because they've got resources that are in politically stable areas of the world, and they're major takeover targets. It's a lot easier to take over one of your neighboring companies than it is to go off to somewhere in deepest, darkest Africa, or go into some jungle in the Congo looking for resources. And that means that you're going to see much more of the type of takeover activity we've seen surrounding Inco, and that could go on for quite a bit longer. It also means that because you have this supply, and because in bull markets you're bound to get lots of strikes because the workers want a bigger cut of the profits, you're going to see supply only rising very gradually, while as demand will be going up just unstoppably, which means you're just going to have some really rather unexpected moves in the metals markets, and it is a secular bull market. Now, I think that's pretty much it for me. If I go on any longer, I think I'll lose my voice. And but if there's anything else we can help you out with, or if there's anything you'd like us to include, or me to include, don't hesitate to contact me, and have a very good weekend.